Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC 89.7 FM, Los Altos Hills. You're tuned in to Rough Edges, the Fred Frith Special. I'm your host, Max Level. Three more hours of Fred Frith music coming up. We just heard from Maybe Monday, which is a project with Larry Oakes, Fred Frith, and Mia Masaoka, and several guests on this CD. Maybe we can get Fred to tell us a little bit about this release in just a couple moments. Right now it's time for a little live music from Fred Frith. Fred is set up with his guitar down in the pit, and he's going to be playing some live music for us right now. Take it away, Fred Frith. Thank you. 89.7 FM and the Fred Frith special, Rough Edges until 4 p.m. Fred is our guest in the studio. Here we just heard a track from the
Happy End Problem.
Oh yeah, tell us about that CD.
These are two sets of compositions that I did with the choreographer we talked about earlier, Amanda Miller. I've done a lot of collaborations with her, and the first piece is from a choreography that she did called Imitation, and it was kind of about the Western way of looking at Japanese culture, so it had a slightly tongue-in-cheek, slightly exaggerated feel, and I was looking for some correspondences in the world of music to try to think about that, and by a fortuitous chance, I had a student at the time at Mills, Kikudei, who was a shakuhachi player, a Japanese-Danish student who's now doing her PhD in London, but she's an extraordinary musician, and she lent herself wholeheartedly to this project, so I had a Japanese instrument played by a Danish musician, which was kind of the focus for the composition. And the great thing about being at Mills College is, of course, that I have wonderful musicians coming through there all the time, so I ended up with quite a few of them on this record. Teresa Wong's playing cello, and who else? Of course, Patrice Scanlon, who I work with a lot, who does electronic treatments, who is now actually the technical director of the intermediate program at Mills, but at the time was a student. And William Wynant, who needs no introduction, I'm sure, is a great percussion virtuoso of the Bay Area, and if not the nation, and a wonderful colleague. So I have great resources when I want to do things like this.
Yeah, you really do. You really do. Thank you very much for the live set that you played. It's about 15 minutes of acoustic guitar. Interesting approach, I'll put it that way.
that sounds... Interesting is a great word, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, people do a lot of different things with guitars and different kinds of techniques with instruments, but yours is quite distinctive. I've seen you play a number of times in different sorts of situations, and there's always something different going on with a guitar when you're playing, and that's, I guess, one of the things you're most known for. Can you explain a little bit about what you were doing there playing
nothing,
live?
Nothing complicated. I'm in the middle of a new beginning at the moment. 1974, I made a record called Guitar Solos, which kind of mapped out the areas of the guitar that I wanted to explore. And I proceeded to explore them, I guess, until the present. And it was all to do with the electric guitar. And it was to do with having a pickup at the wrong end of the neck. And it was to do with preparation to a certain degree. So that's the territory out of which I've been working on the electric guitar ever since. It took me a while to get started. I made the record and then didn't really do very much for 5 or 6 years, and then finally started exploring the material. Well, after a conversation with John Zorn, I decided to make a record of acoustic guitar solos a couple of years ago, which is now out on SADC. It's called To Sail, To Sail. And this kind of, in a way, has done the same for me. It's mapped out a territory that I feel like I can now spend the next part of my life exploring. And what you just heard was me doing just that. It was taking some of the things that I came up with while doing that recording and working with them. And in this case, the only thing that's different about the guitar is that there's a very old loom spindle threaded through the guitar in such a way that there are two different keyboards, one above and one below the spindle, and the one above doesn't have any frets and is an octave higher than the one that's below the spindle, which does have frets. And it has some of the characteristics of a koto, which kind of responded to the music that you played right afterwards. And it also has some of the characteristics of a guitar, and I was playing it mostly with my fingers, but also with a bow. So the bow kind of gives it another separation, a degree of separation from the sound that you expect to hear from a guitar. But actually, since I was largely dealing with open sonorities, there wasn't very much work for me to do. It's just more or less listening to what's going on and allowing it to happen in as efficient a way as I can.
Paintbrushes.
Oh, did I use paintbrushes?
Yes, you did.
Sorry about that. What can I say? They happened to be there, and there they were. And they're softer than drumsticks, so they don't beat up the guitar quite as much.
Yeah. That's another thing I was going to ask you about. I'm not sure how to put this gracefully, but what's the chance of damaging an instrument in some of the things you do? I mean, I know that you're not outrageously harsh, but at the same time, I mean, I see you drop things on the pickups and scrape things across the strings and things, and I'm just kind of wondering, you know, is there a real sense of wanting to make sounds, but at the same time wanting to take care of the instrument as well? Because I'm sure you have some very nice instruments in your collection.
Well, my main instrument is a Gibson 345 that's from 1959 and has the original pickups, and I've been playing it for 40 years, and it's still going strong, so I guess I'm not doing too much damage. A lot of what you see is gestural, but it's not actually quite what you think. I mean, a guitar bow dragged across strings is actually what the guitar bow is designed to do. So there's not particularly any danger involved in it. And very often I mediate what I'm dragging by placing something in between it and the strings. So because the guitar has this characteristic of amplifying what happens, if you place a tin lid on the strings, you can scrape whatever you want on the tin lid. I can drop things into it and bow it and play it with a rasp file or anything else. It's not actually touching the guitar at all. It's touching the tin lid. So I have a lot of very damaged tin lids. But my guitar is in great shape.
And the guitar is just resonating what you're doing.
Yeah. It passes the energy through the strings and into the pickups.
What is? I think you just brought it up a couple minutes ago. What is it you were saying about a pickup on the wrong end of a guitar? Because it seems like I've seen you playing the Gibson with cables and things coming out of the. What am I trying to say?
It's funny when people talk about
the nut end rather than
exaggerate. Not cables. A cable.
Oh, a cable. Okay. But, so, I mean, you have electronics up
have,
on the peg head end, right?
It's just a pickup. It's just like the other pickups, except that it's suspended over the first fret on a little harness that you can take off the guitar, so it's not doing any permanent damage to the guitar. And I can also flap it off, so I don't have to have it there. But I usually do. And I have a pedal array which is precisely split in two, so I have the pickup at the wrong end of the so-called wrong end, the nut end of the neck, going through one array of pedals, and the normal pickups going through the other array. So I have a kind of a left foot, right foot, right hand, left hand configuration. It's a four-limbed approach, mm-hmm. as Tom Corey used to say, and it depends very much on having two volume pedals so that I can actually hear one side and not the other side or both sides, and they're constantly filtering in and out. So what it's enabled me to do is to especially make transitions much more flexible. I don't have to stop what I'm doing and start again. I can actually continue something with one hand and get something ready for the other hand. Mm-hmm. And this has translated itself into my acoustic playing. I mean, if you saw what I was just doing, I've become rather independent with each hand mm-hmm. as a result of having to deal with two completely separate sounds. So in a way, what I'm now doing with the acoustic guitar is dispensing with all the electrical part, but retaining the independent part mm-hmm. and seeing where that leads me.
The spindle that you had under the strings, now I didn't realize it. I mean, I guess I'm probably a little bit naive, but I didn't realize that's actually in a tuned position then you were talking about. It's got one octave. Well, I just thought maybe you put it under there to give you an artificial bridge to kind of press the strings against.
That too, but
you know?
I mean, where you place it completely changes what you're hearing. Yeah, like yeah. I have about seven positions where I can place it, which will produce different sets of tunings, and how you tune the strings will produce another. You know, I've just spent a week down at Lou Harrison's Straw Bale House actually preparing a concert that I did down there, and it was a very good opportunity to actually write down and codify the practices that I'm engaged in so that I can reproduce them. So which is exactly what I did 40 years ago when I did guitar solos. I actually mapped out the scales that I got when I played only with my left hand to the left of a capo so that I could see exactly what the notes were, and very often they're microtonal, they're not in any kind of tonal relationship, so I had to learn how to use those and see which ones are actually the same and which ones are different, mm-hmm. and the fact that it's logarithmic and not even scale and all the rest of it, it's kind of interesting.
There's more to it than just whacking on a guitar with a with a bow and a paintbrush.
Well, I like whacking on the guitar with a bow and a paintbrush, but there has been a little work to get to that point.
Yeah, it's done just the right way. I didn't want to forget, too, the couple of things that we played before you did your live set. We heard that Compass Log and Lead, and we also heard from Maybe Monday. Can you explain a little bit about Maybe Monday? I know it's basically a trio project, and then on this particular CD, Unsquare, you had several guests. Can you talk a little bit about Maybe Monday and then also about this particular CD?
Maybe Monday came about, Mia and I had worked together. We'd actually toured together with Tom Cora way back. And we thought it would be a nice idea for a trio. I don't know whose idea it was. It might have been Larry. It might have been Mia. It might have been me. I really don't remember. But we started a trio a long time ago. And played occasionally, not as much as I would have liked. And it was always really magical. There was something really interesting going on. So we did a record, and then we did another record called Digital Wildlife, where I took recordings that we'd done with a guest, Joan Renault, and we spent some time reworking the recordings and manipulating them and turning them into compositions and doing stuff. That was kind of my project for maybe Monday. And then this project, which was the next one, involved going to New York and playing The Stone in New York. And we had different guests each night. So we had Zena Parkins, we had Ikwe Mori, we had Jerry Hemingway, we had Carla Kielstedt playing with us as guests. But we also did a recording session involving all of them playing all together. And so this record is the result of the recording session, as far as I remember.
I think that's what the liner notes say, yes, yeah. Yes.
And
yeah.
There is another set of recordings from the concerts, which I'm supposed to be turning into another record, which is the second part of this particular project, which I hope will be my summer work this summer. Mm-hmm. Will be to try to get that finally organized. It's been a while, but so the group lives on in various manifestations.
I remember reading something about, I don't believe it was this CD, but it was one of the early ones by Maybe Monday, where there was, trying to remember how it went, there was some sort of studio manipulation of the sounds while you were playing, although you were unaware really of what was happening until you went back and listened to it. That seems like a kind of strange process.
That was Digital Wildlife. This was the thing that I produced, and it's was dependent on having somebody, in the case of Miles Boysen, who's an engineer and musician, great guitar player, somebody I've known since actually 30 years now. And I do practically all of my recording at his studio in Oakland, and he's a very good friend. And he was charged with precisely doing whatever he wanted. He was a kind of a fifth member of the ensemble and could do anything he wanted while we were recording it, and we could choose to either hear what he was doing or not to, depending on if we were wearing headphones or not and if we had him in the mix or not. So in a lot of cases, we simply had no idea what he was doing. And the other thing that was important to me is that we didn't have too many choices afterwards, so there were no lots and lots of tracks. It was all recorded to two tracks.
So there wasn't like a straight version and a treated version.
No,
The version was the version,
and yeah. Then I took that away and basically archived it. In other words, decided on the characteristics of the whole thing and wrote it all down, and then kind of posited an idea about how that might be reconstructed. And then I went into a studio in Germany, where I also work a lot with Peter Hart, the engineer I work with over there, and we kind of made a new structure with it all and tried treating it in different ways after the fact and basically recomposing the material. And then I submitted that to the Maybe Monday folks, and they gave me their feedback, and then I went back again based on what they said and ended up with what we ended up with.
You've done a lot of work with Larry. You've played with him in a lot of different configurations.
Absolutely. I mean, going back to when we played together, I think when I first came out to the Bay Area, when Rover was just starting, we played together at the Bear's Lair, as far as I remember, way back. And over the years since, and the Rover have commissioned pieces from me on a couple of occasions, pieces that I'm very attached to, I must say. And I've worked, I was the bass player on Electric Ascension, and so yeah, it goes on.
Yeah, that was an amazing concert there. We could talk a long time about that. I was privileged to be in the audience for that one, and actually our station broadcast that one live. So we were all over that one. I was going to say, we have a couple of CDs to give away. Fred was nice enough to donate a couple of CDs, so I'd like to give one of them away in the next couple of minutes here. It is To Sail, To Sail. It's the acoustic guitar solo record that Fred was talking about. Came out, was it last year? It's on Zatica.
Yeah, it came out last
2008.
Year.
2008. And it's all solo acoustic guitar pieces. And I think, are they mostly or all dedicated to different musicians?
They're like, all dedicated to almost always musicians, except there's one dedicated to my brother, Chris, who is a musician, but that's not his profession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, well, I'd like to give a copy of this CD away. If you are let's make it the second caller at 650-941-2500, you can claim a copy of this CD, and we'll have another CD to give away before too much longer. Now we're going to go into some more music. This is something that Fred wanted me to play for you. So can you tell us a little bit about what this is, Fred, and then we'll hear it.
Well, it just occurred to me after we were listening to The Happy End Problem, which and we were talking about the resources that come through Mills. We have such incredible musicians coming to Mills to study. I mean, nominally to study, but I must say I'm studying as much with them as the other way around. And Wu Fei is a case in point. She's a virtuoso player of the guzheng and a wonderful composer. And she invited me to play with her on her first record, and she's now... her career seems to be taking off big time, but I'm very happy to be still having an association with her, and this is from her solo record, which is called A Distant Youth.
Okay, this track is called Dao Chan. I don't know, I'm not...
Dao Chan,
okay. It's here on KFJC and the Fred Frith Special till 4 p.m. 89.7 KFJC and Rough Edges, the Fred Frith Special, approaching its second hour before too much longer. Fred Frith is our guest in the studio here. Fred, can you tell us what we just heard?
You just heard Shufeng, which is one of John Zorn's game pieces, a record that came out a few years back. It's a piece for two guitars, two keyboards, two drums. And in this case, I get to play with a real guitar player, John Schott, and that's the one who sounded like a guitar player, and I can actually play the instrument, and me. And Willie Winant and Dave Lombardo on drums, and Chris Brown and Dave Slusser doing electronic stuff. So it's a pretty hot group, one could say.
There's a lizard. I'm sorry. A lizard on the floor back there. Just dropped off the wall. I love this place. Can you explain the game pieces concept? I know John Zorn has had different sorts of conducting and composing strategies involving different types of ensembles. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the game pieces are not so much... I mean, the conductor is the wrong word. It's a prompter. So the thing that characterizes the game pieces is that the musicians... There's a whole bunch of different activities that you can engage in. And you can suggest them, and the prompter takes your suggestion and then relays it to the group. That's the basic principle of the idea. So the conductor is there to get instructions from you and relay them back to everybody else. So there's a kind of a complicated chain of command, which the prompter, in principle, doesn't really have control over. It's the musicians who have control over it, although the prompter can, in certain cases, try to clear the air by, if there are too much instruction going on, they can veto things, and they usually do. Because, in a sense, they're predicated on the whole thing about the social aspects of improvising. So you tend to immediately see the kind of people who want to control everything and the kind of people who basically are quite happy to be left to be told what to do, and people who are kind of trying to make a real composition out of it, and people who are just trying to, you know, be busy. And it brings out all of these characteristics. It's quite fascinating to watch sometimes to see how people interact with each other.
So where do you think you would tend to fall in that dynamic as far as someone who's trying to direct it or someone who wants to be told what to do or make a composition out of it? Or
I kind of consciously, every time I do them, I consciously adopt different roles. Mm. So for this, I mean, because a piece might last any length of time. It might be a 2-minute version, it might be a 10-minute version. But every time I do a version, I will probably try a different approach. So I might do a very assertive approach, or I might do a very passive approach, or I might take a very composerly approach. I mean, I'm always kind of, because once you've taken the approach, I don't want to be thinking too much about it when I'm doing it. So I find it easier just to be have one mindset and then get on with it rather than get confused. So that works for me. Other people, I'm sure it works differently in different ways. So,
what would be the method of relaying your instructions to the prompter? I mean, how does he know what it is that you're trying to direct?
The last person I did this game piece with was actually Myra Melford at Mills, because my ensemble and at Mills and her ensemble at Berkeley combined for a concert, and during the concert we did a version of Cobra, which is his best known game piece, and she was basically waiting for people to tell her what to do. That's all that happens. I mean, it's visual. You actually point, and there's systems where you touch your mouth or you touch your ear, and you say, you know, and then she has cards which she shows to the musicians. And
that's I was kind of wondering how that worked.
Yeah, it's like that. I mean, the funniest, the very first time I did a game piece. Originally they were all sports game pieces, and eventually he kind of went over to war games. So Cobra and Shufeng are both kind of the later games, the war games. But I was involved in one of the very first performances of his piece, Archery, which was in 1979. And I remember this for two different reasons. One was that it was the first time I'd met Tom Cora, and we'd both recently arrived in New York, he from Virginia and me from Europe, and we found ourselves going the wrong way on the subway and ending up in Harlem. And I got out and asked the way, and it was like walking into Africa, really. I was the only white person there, and I was very naive and cheerful, and I asked somebody how should I get to Columbia? And he said, best thing to do would be to get back in the subway. So I did. And I was in the subway, and on the other side of the platform was Tom with his cello and me with my guitar. And we were facing each other from opposite sides, and we both understood intuitively that we were probably going to the same place, and one of us must be wrong.
So you're going in opposite directions?
Yeah. So we figured it out, and that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. But the other thing that I remember about the first performance of Archery that was also involved Toshinori Kondo, who was from recently arrived from Tokyo and didn't speak any English at all. And we had rehearsed this piece for several days. It was very complicated, much more complicated than the later pieces. And he had absolutely no idea what was going on. So he just basically went with the flow. And we got to, I think we were doing it at Columbia, and we went up there, and that's just how we got lost. And we did the performance, and there was a review in the New York Times next day, and basically Kondo just basically played. I mean, he really didn't know what we were doing. He just went along.
He can play some pretty straight-ahead jazz, though,
he's
right?
He's a great player.
Yeah.
Wonderful player. Anyway, he was playing great. And the review in the New York Times the next day said that the only person who really seemed to know what they were doing was Toshinori Kondo. which remained a source of mirth for many years to come.
Ironic, isn't it? Yeah.
But in a way, he did know what he was doing.
Yeah, to just go with it. Yeah. You mentioned Tom Kaur. I'd like to, at some point today, make an effort to get into the Skeleton Crew stuff and talk a little bit about that stuff. You have some... Oh, excellent. Okay. I've got scratchy old vinyl here. If you have something that's a little better to listen to, I'd like to work towards that and play some of that in a little while if we could. Okay. You were just talking about working with John Zorn. Now, we've got a CD here, which is a duo CD, Frith and Zorn. Tell me about this, and then we'll hear a little sample of that.
Well, Zorn and I have been playing together as a duo for a very long time, starting in 79. And it's funny to me to remember that our first concerts were in his apartment in New York. And we used to play in the living room, and there was room for the five people who came to sit in comfort, and we would play in the living room. And as things started to get more known, we ended up in the kitchen. In which case there were probably maybe 20 people there, and eventually we understood that we would need a slightly bigger place to perform than his apartment, so we branched out to a place where you could get 50 people. And so that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship, obviously. And this was a recording that we did for his 50th birthday month at the Stone, whenever his 50th birthday was, which I think is about 7 years ago. And one of the things that I find funny when people produce things like game pieces, which seem to be dictated by the musicians, is how much they reflect in the end the sensibility of the person who devised them. There's always, you can always hear John Zorn's sensibility in any version of any of his game pieces. And that's partly to do with the musicians he chooses to play them. But, you know, I've heard them played by people he didn't choose, and it's just the same is still true. And I think if you hear this, you will notice the extreme similarity to what we've just been listening to in terms of the sensibility of it, even though he wasn't playing in the last piece at all.
Now, is this all improvised?
This is an improvised concert from the Stone in New York, yeah.
Okay, well, let's check this out. It's on 89.7 KFJC.
Ah!
KFJC 89.7 FM, the Fred Frith Special. Fred's our guest here in the studio. I'm your host, Max Level, in till 4 p.m., broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC 89.7 FM, Los Altos Hills. We just heard the sound of Massacre from 1981, and here's Fred to tell us all about that project.
Well, Massacre came about because Henry Cow broke up the band I'd been in for 10 years, and I was a bit lost. And my old friend Giorgio Gomelski, who had moved to New York, who was a renowned entrepreneur, the original manager of the Rolling Stones, the first producer of John McLaughlin, the manager for many years of
Yardbirds.
A very colorful character, to say the least, who I'd known because of his time managing Magma in France. And he'd moved to the States, and he called me and said, you know, this is basically where it's happening, and you'd be crazy not to be here, and I'll send you a ticket. And he did. Mm-hmm. So I had a ticket, and he said, don't worry about, you know, he was doing a festival called the Mani Festival, the New York Zoo Mani Festival, I don't know what it was. He was trying to combine the most progressive elements of what was happening in New York and Europe at the time. And he said, don't worry about playing, just come and see what's going on. So I didn't bring a guitar or anything. I flew to New York, where I'd never been to the States before, and walked over from the bus station to his house on 23rd Street. He had a loft on 23rd Street. And when I got there, this band was playing in the basement. It was a band with Bill Laswell and Michael Beinhorn, Fred Maher, and Cliff Coltrary, and they were playing one of my pieces, a piece from the Art Bears, actually, except that the piece was written in 15/8, and they were playing it in 4/4, which was much more kind of dancely.